Direction point! Direction point!
A Doctor Who Podcast Network.
Well, hi everybody! Welcome back to Doctor Who Literature. My name is Jason. This is, by my calculations, going to be the second shortest episode ever of Doctor Who Literature, related to a particular book, since I started featuring guests on my show back in Episode 5, Doctor Who and the Cave Monsters, with Stacey Smith. The occasion this week is the first book that is not a novelization of a Doctor Who TV serial, but rather an original novel in its own right. We're talking about The Companions of Doctor Who, a three-book cycle introduced in 1986. This book is Turlough and the Earth-Link Dilemma by Tony Atwood, who never wrote any other Doctor Who fiction that I'm aware of. It is the first original Doctor Who novel, and there is a long and honorable line of Doctor Who novels to follow this one for the next 40 years. How successful Turlough and the Earth-Link Dilemma is compared to some of its illustrious followers is a question very much to be determined, and I have a Doctor Who novelist with me this week. Rejoining the show is Dale Smith, and we're going to talk this one through. I will also do a brief audio essay at the back end of that conversation. If you have not read Turlough and the Earth-Link Dilemma, I don't think it's strictly necessary to have read it in order to enjoy this podcast. I have intentionally avoided spoilers, and I am not doing a chapter-by-chapter, page-by-page breakdown of the prose and plot, but rather giving my general impression in the audio essay as to what this book is about, why it matters, what works, and especially what doesn't quite work and might not strike your fancy. I had made the conscious decision to not buy this book when it first came out in 1986 for reasons, not very good reasons, but I will go into them in the audio essay. I had never read this book before this week. I'm not exactly glad that I did. This is not a story or prose that I'm going to carry around with me for the rest of my life and quote to other people at dinner parties, but it's an interesting experiment, and it's a worthy experiment, because Doctor Who original novels are the future, and this is the first book to get there. On the other side of the break, Dale Smith will join me, and we'll talk this one out. Other things are going on in my life. Callie and I have started watching, in my case, re-watching, and in her case, watching for the first time, Buffy the Vampire Slayer. We're doing an episode a night, and we just finished season one. I did offer her the opportunity to skip some of the less essential Beast of the Week episodes in season one, but she wanted to watch the whole thing. 21st century girl, a child of the binge-watching era. Some of the Beast of the Week episodes she liked more than others, but she was very taken with the dialogue and the acting, especially Buffy and Willow. I've given her a small idea about what's to come in season two. I have tried to avoid any spoilers. She does have friends who've watched the show all the way through, so there's probably some things that she knows about what's coming via cultural osmosis. She did make some predictions along the way, which are disturbingly accurate, so she may already know what's to come. But I am not going to be spoiling anything for her directly. There's some great episodes in Season 2 and Season 3. And then, of course, much later on, there is Hush, and there's the musical episode, and I'm very curious to gauge her reaction to that. Maybe I'll get her back on Doctor Who Literature to discuss that for a bonus episode after we reach a certain point in the show. But, of course, you are not here to talk about my parenting or to talk about Buffy the Vampire Slayer. You are here because you love The Companions of Doctor Who, Turlough and the Earth-Link Dilemma. So, let's get to it.
They all say, who is Doctor Who? This is Tim Treloar.
This is David J. Howe.
I'm Peter Purvis.
I am Sadie Miller.
This is Lauren Cornelius.
Larry, it's Fraser.
For all things in the Doctor Who collecting world and beyond, the Doctor Who Collectors Podcast, I'm Larry Van Mersbergen, your host, and I've been collecting for 42 years. You're listening to Doctor Who Literature on the Direction Point Podcast Network. Keep turning the pages.
Very happy to welcome back to Doctor Who Literature for the first time in too long, Dale Smith. Dale, welcome back.
Hello.
The last time that you and I spoke, you had submitted, I believe, the manuscript for the Black Archive on Greatest Show in the Galaxy. And since we last recorded, that has, in fact, come out. And I do have my digital copy. And I was very happy to see that my name appears in the acknowledgments, which, of course, I'll be fair, that was the first page that I turned to.
Well, you did keep me going through the writing of it, so it was only fair.
This is not our Greatest Show in the Galaxy episode, but since it is your most recent published work, I do want to spend a few minutes talking about it. Since it's been a while since I last had you on, what was the genesis of that particular book, and how did it come to pass?
I think the idea came to me while I was rewatching it and noticing all the parallels that it had with the era of Doctor Who that it was being made in. So you've got a fake Doctor and Ace in it as the Captain and Mags, and just watching the little parallels that looked like somebody was making comments on Doctor Who. And I'd seen some of them picked up, but I hadn't seen anybody collate them all into a single place before, and I thought that might be a starting point. And then the other thing that I've wanted to do for decades now is to write something about UK hip hop, because I grew up on that music. And every time I've tried to get somebody to do it, they've always said no, because I've always asked the wrong people. It was, I think the first time I suggested it to anyone, it was just after I'd had a Telos Time Hunter novella published. So I asked David J. Howe how he felt about UK hip hop. And unsurprisingly, he said it wasn't really the kind of thing that Telos published. But with that being the only intersection between hip hop and Doctor Who, it was the obvious place to try and do that. So from there, it was just looking at it and seeing what else there was in it that I wanted to talk about. And it is an interesting story, because it's right at that cusp where Andrew Cartmell's coming in and seeing that he can do something with it. And it's the point at which it gets as Alan Moore-y as it's ever going to get. So it's a really interesting bit of the show to talk about. And it's the period that's just coming, as far as you're concerned on this podcast, isn't it? Because we're in 1986 at the minute, so you're only 2 years off.
Yes, we are currently in the middle of the run of the season 22 novelizations that we're going to get. Although, famously, Revelation of the Daleks is not going to come out for another 33 years of real time. But at the same time, the Target books are dipping back and forth. So you'll get a cutting edge book for a story that was televised a year ago, and then you'll get a book that came out, a TV story that came out 20 years earlier, and then it'll alternate like that. And then you have the unfortunate incident of The Vengeance on Varos was supposed to be the next book released in the month after this one, and of course that did not come to happen for another 2 years. So by the time Vengeance on Varos comes out, it's got the wrong logo, and it's got a book number that's 22 digits before the book that had come out previously. But yes, we are going to be getting the McCoy novelizations very, very soon, probably in about 4 months on this podcast, when Time of the Rani finally comes out. But we're very close in real time to the McCoy era, which begins not even 18 months after the month in which we are in right now. When I first saw Greatest Show on the Galaxy, and I'll say that again because it's not called Greatest Show on the Galaxy, it's called Greatest Show in the Galaxy. When I first saw it, it probably comes out my final year of high school. Probably I see it in 1990. That's my best recollection as to when I would have seen it. And it was the only time that my PBS station ever got to air it, because my PBS dropped Doctor Who midway through my first year of college, early 1992. The very first thing you see, of course, is the rap. And 1989, 1990, hip-hop is taking over mainstream American culture. The first acknowledged rap performance had been in the Bronx, New York City, not even 15 years earlier, but by this point, it's already responsible for number one songs on the Billboard chart, and it's what white kids my age growing up in suburbia are compulsively listening to, me being a little bit younger than David J. Howe. This opens with a rap, and I was immediately hooked and mesmerized, and I immediately tried to learn it, although my rhyme and meter skills are not quite as good as that of Rico Ross, who performed it. Who wrote that rap? Was that actually written by Stephen Wyatt, or was it done by the composer for the serial, or was it freestyled by the actor?
So it was written by Stephen Wyatt, and there's a section in the Black Archive about that being written. But the music was done by Mark Ayers, and he based it on a single that was in the charts at the time by a UK rapper called Derek B, who was not the coolest rapper of the era, but he was very important for getting UK hip hop to a lot of new people. So he would have been one of the first rappers I'd heard, and then probably spent the next 5 years denying that I ever liked him. But he died very young, and people have been looking back at his legacy since then and reassessing the impact that he had, and he was very important to the whole thing. But yeah, Mark Ayers based the music on that, did some scratching without using record decks. He got a tape machine and ran the tape forwards and backwards very fast to get the scratch sound. And it's not the world's greatest representation for UK hip hop, but it is for the time. It's a good stab at something that you could put on the BBC.
1989 in the States had been the summer of Public Enemy, but yes. The rap songs that were reaching number one were not the socially conscious, musically complex ones. The most popular rap performances at about the time that I watched Greatest Show in the Galaxy probably is Busta Move by Young MC, which is a good party track, but it's not particularly socially groundbreaking. And then, of course, the infamous Ice Ice Baby by Vanilla Ice, which I believe was the first rap song to go to number one in the States, which tells you about the sorry focus of American pop culture at the time. So that was what immediately grabbed me about Greatest Show. But then, about 15 minutes in, you get the Wiz Kid. And unfortunately, when you look like me and my face is kind of Wiz Kid adjacent, I immediately took this personally, and it put me on a sour note against the rest of the story. When I first reached the internet, there were rumors that this was based on a particular individual, and it was based perhaps on certain American fans who were not appreciating the way the show and the way that British fans did. And I've also heard thought that this may have been a reflection on Chris Chibnall, who had appeared on TV and issued similar sentiments in 1986, although I think that's probably too deep a cut for the writer. Was WizKid based on anybody in particular, or was he based on specific Doctor Who fandom, or was this just an obsessive individual in general not drawn from the ranks of our own fandom?
So the genesis of Great Show in the Galaxy took a long time. There was lots of drafts of it done, and it changed a huge amount in between the first idea for it, which was basically why don't we do a show set in a circus, until the final scripts for it. The Wiz Kid started off as being a computer game fan and someone who's really good at computer games, because it was going to be more like The Nightmare Fair in that it was a computer gamey thing that they were getting pulled into rather than an overtly circusy thing. And then in between the second and third drafts, Stephen White made him a generic Doctor Who fan, and that was one of the things about the story that J&T picked up on and thought was really good, so that stuck all the way through the end. The like I say, there is a rumour that it was based on Chris Chibnall specifically, but I did ask, and it's not, apparently. So, but yeah, it's more of a generic Doctor Who fan, and I think a bit of an opportunity for J&T to have a go back at the people who were having a go at him at that era, because it was just as we got into the height of the campaigns to try and get him kicked off the programme, which, with hindsight, where, you know, the BBC also didn't want him making the programme, and if he hadn't been there, the programme would have stopped. So if the fan campaigns had been successful, that would have been the end of Doctor Who.
There is a defense of Chris Chibnall's appearance on television, and we will be featuring that in an upcoming episode. So I certainly don't want to take any digs at him personally. For my money, he is the best of the three showrunners that the new series has had, and I came to that conclusion after doing my new series pilgrimage towards the end of pandemic lockdown. But I did not take WizKid the right way. When I was a kid, I took it personally, and it was a long time before I could appreciate Greatest Show in the Galaxy for what it is. And your Black Archive certainly helps, I think, set the record straight, at least as far as young Jason is concerned. But we're about 10 minutes or so into this recording, so let's segue neatly into the reason that we are here today. We are now reading the very first original Doctor Who novel. We are reading what is, in essence, if not in fact, a template for what the New Adventures and the Missing Adventures would eventually be. This is a story without the Doctor in it, but it is an original novel taking us through the further adventures of Turlough. And this comes out in 1986, so Turlough is still fairly fresh in the minds of TV viewers, even though he departed the show about 2 years before the novel came out. And there will be a few more of these before the Target line ends and morphs into the New Adventures. You came to my attention as a writer of an original Doctor Who novel, which came out less than 20 years after this one did. How influential was Turlough and the Earthlink Dilemma to a young Dale Smith? And when you wrote your first novel, were you thinking to yourself, I am following where Turlough and the Earthlink Dilemma blazed the trail, and my book is going to be an homage to this one?
I think probably not when I was starting off on writing the original Doctor Who books, but it was a very influential book to me. It was, when I was younger, I very much enjoyed this book, and having reread it now for the first time since I first read it, which was when it first came out, it's not the book I remembered it to be, but there are still bits in it which are. All of the stuff I remember about liking it came in the last couple of chapters. So the way that time travel suddenly becomes a way for the story to evolve. So you get Turlough coming back and giving himself warnings from the future about the mistakes he's about to make, and changes the direction that the plot's going in. And at the end, where you get Turlough is his mind is infected with the mind of the bad guy, and he gets put in a bottomless pit in an alternate timeline because he's saving the life of the woman that he was supposed to be married to if he hadn't been exiled. It's very complicated, but bits like that had stayed with me all the way through until I read it again. And it's a different use of time travel for Doctor Who. Doctor Who doesn't do time travel as a method of fixing the story. People don't get a second go at running through what's just happened, because they've got a time machine. If something happens in Doctor Who, it's usually fixed and you can't change it. Whereas in Turlo, three planets get blown up in nuclear explosions and Turlo gets to go back and divert the story onto another track so that none of that ever happens. And you've done a couple of episodes now where you've mentioned the Mythmakers Essentials book, which Richard Saltwood did. I was also in that. And the essential that I chose was time travel. And the story I wrote did a similar thing with time travel, of having someone try again and again to fix one problem by using time travel and going back and going back. And I'm fairly convinced that that is from Turlo.
Doctor Who will eventually follow this trail, because in the 1996 TV movie, you have time going into reverse in order to undo some tragedies. And then at around the same time, you have the Stephen Moffat short story through Virgin Publishing, Continuity Errors, which later morphs into an actual televised episode, A Christmas Carol. So Doctor Who will eventually go down this road. And yes, it is fair to say that Turlo and the Earthling Dilemma gets there first. So you would have first read this as the book is released in mid-1986?
Yeah, so when I was in secondary school, my mother was my school librarian, and she took me out on summer holiday to the edges of the town centre, where there was a big tower block, and she said, inside this tower block is the company that provides all of the library books for schools in Leicestershire. And she let me go in and pick out books that I thought would be the kind of things I want to read, so she could put them in the library for kids my age. One of the books that I found in there was a copy of Turlo and the Earthling Dilemma, which confused me because I had no idea what this book was, because I wasn't particularly connected to Doctor Who fandom, so I had no idea it was coming out or what was happening with it. And so that was the first one I picked and said, this one, oh, and by the way, can I borrow it and read it? So I read it over a summer holiday and then gave it back, and it went into the library, and I don't know if anyone else ever took it out.
It is at about 220 pages. It is 80 pages longer than most of the longest Target books of the era. And it's not a novelization of anything. It is an original story. So this is a bold way forward for the line. And there are going to be two more of these before readers' interest runs out and they stop making any more, until 1991, when we get the New Adventures, and this is the wave of the future. In terms of plotting and writing style, is this an important book for Doctor Who fans to read as we discover the evolution of Doctor Who literature, so to speak?
I would say it is a very important book. So the story of how the book came about is Tony Atwood, who was the writer of it, had written a Blake 7 guide for Target Books, and that had been freelance edited by Nigel Robinson. Off the back of that, Tony Atwood got invited to a convention where he met Mark Strickson. And in the bar in the evening, they started talking about Doctor Who and writing and what a good idea it would be if somebody wrote a story about Turlo, which is an odd thing for an actor to still be invested in their character, because it was about a year after he'd left the show. But they talked about it and they managed to convince each other that it was a brilliant idea. So Tony Atwood then took it to Target, who accepted it as a one-off book and said, yeah, we'll do this. We'll have to sort out the licensing for it, because our license only covers televised stories, but we think it's worth it and we'll give it a go. Because at that time, the last season of Doctor Who had 6 stories in it, And at the end of that season, the BBC had announced that they didn't like Doctor Who anymore and they were planning on getting rid of it. When it eventually came back, it had been cut back, so it only had seasons of four stories and would carry on that way until it was properly cancelled again at the end of the McCoy era. The people at Target were starting to get quite concerned because they did 12 books a year and they knew that they were running out of stories, and at some point either they would lose the money that they were making from selling Doctor Who books, which were a steady income for them, or they'd have to think of something else. So after the book got commissioned, Nigel Robinson took over as the editor of Target Books, and he saw the potential for a way forward with this book, because John Nathan Turner wouldn't let them do original stories about Doctor Who, because he argued that there were still stories going on the telly and you couldn't clash that way. But the idea of having a story where companions who had left the show and you had no idea what was going to happen to them, companions didn't come back again after they'd left in the old days. So they were free and open to do. And so he saw there was potential for it to be a range that could take over once the Doctor Who books dried up. And that's when he spoke to Ian Marta about the book that you will be doing at some point in the future. Which is Harry Sullivan's War, which was the next book out and the last of it, the last book that was considered to be the possibility of it being a range. Because it was after that book that they decided that the sales weren't good enough and they were gonna not do any more. And K9 and Company came out a year later with the same branding, but that was more of a let's try and make it look like it's a thing exercise, because K9 and Company had come out on the TV, so it was essentially a novelization, but didn't really fit in with the ongoing range.
K9 and Company was made as part of season 19. As part of the season 19 budget, which is why season 19 is two episodes shorter than season 18 had been. K9 and Company is the equivalent of two 25-minute Doctor Who episodes. But yes, it is a proper novelization rather than an original story that had never been told before. And that's one of the great things about the Doctor Who family, so to speak, because you have a Mark Strickson or an Ian Marta who are invested in characters that they are no longer playing. And of course, everybody involved in the making of this book is exactly right. Original novels are the future for Doctor Who. Now, Star Trek was doing original novels at about the same time, and they had been doing it for the original series, which was long off the air, and they're about to begin doing it for Next Generation, which is about, again, almost 18 months away as this book comes out and hits the shelves in May 1986. But original Doctor Who novels have never gone away, because you have the uninterrupted run of the two Virgin Publishing and then the two BBC books lines from 1991 to 2005. And then you still have original books coming out almost throughout the entirety of the new series, from the first Christopher Eccleston season all the way up to Jodie Whittaker. Now, the books have changed in scope and complexity, but Turlough and the Earthlink Dilemma is the very first one. And I think later books would do a little bit better in terms of prose and plotting and perhaps readability, because this is the first time that I've ever read it. And I'll save my thoughts for the audio essay that follows this interview. But I did find this book, especially in the earlier chapters, where every chapter takes place in a different locale, and there's really not a lot of forward momentum yet. I did find the book a little bit tough sledding, especially compared to some of the later original novels that come out and are much better in terms of readability and pace. So let me ask you the same questions drawn from Darren Mooney's movies podcast, The 250, that I've been asking everybody else over the last month or so. Thinking about the first 60 years of Doctor Who, does Turlough and the Earthlink Dilemma belong on a list of the 60 greatest Doctor Who novels ever written?
That is tricky because you would be getting rid of a lot, but I think for what it is, I think it would have to go on the list just because it's so atypical. It prefigures a lot of things that would come after it. So it's got a central mystery, which admittedly isn't handled amazingly, about the prehistory of Tryon and the different alien races that live there. And it's got a sort of Babylon 5-esque feel to the backstory of these alien races that are doing things before the humans come along. It's got the bit in the maze at the end where Turlo is just thrown into a maze that doesn't seem to have a way out, and he's got to work his way through it. And I think that prefigures a horror film called The Cube, which came out in the 90s. It does atypical things for Doctor Who stories. It uses time travel in a different way, and it tries to drill down into this central question of why does the Doctor keep going back to Earth? And to do that, it uses a lot of real world science in more detail than Doctor Who ever did. Not all of it is used accurately or for any great effect. So a lot of the ship drives are based on things like muons or neutrinos, and it feels like they've just been chosen as sciencey words that will do. But then there is also running through it a central theme of the idea of a unified theory of everything, which is a real thing in science. And the reason why you can't have one is how it tells you in the book. It's that gravity doesn't fit in with everything. And the book takes a Doctor Who go at it and says, well, the reason for that is we're on a planet where some aliens have done something that makes gravity look weird. And that's where the story comes from. So it does a lot of things that you couldn't find in any of the other novelizations. And then on top of that, it does try to find a way to make the novelizations into an ongoing range if Doctor Who dies. So it is definitely a continuation of the novelization of Planet of Fire. It isn't a continuation of the TV story. There's a lot of backstory about the Imperial clans and what happens on Tryon that just isn't in the TV show. It's only in the novelization. And it, as the first original book that Target ever did, it's the one that ran out into the dark and bumped into all the obstacles and then gave Peter Darvill Evans a good idea of where things could easily go wrong when he was trying to set up the new adventures. So it isn't, despite what my 12-year-old self thought, it isn't the greatest Doctor Who book ever, but it certainly is one that's definitely in a moment of history and did something that needed doing at that point, and so it needs to be remembered for that, if nothing else.
Second question. Is Turlo and the Earthlink Dilemma on your list of your 60 favorite original Doctor Who novels?
Yeah, you have broken my childhood just a little bit by getting me to reread it. But I did volunteer, so it is my own fault. But yeah, it wouldn't be one that if the house burnt down, I rushed upstairs to try and get off the shelf. I am glad I read it again, and it isn't as bad as a lot of people have made it out to be. So people have said that the version of Turlo in it isn't believable as being Turlo, but I don't see that even rereading it now. He very much talks like Turlo, acts like Turlo, but a Turlo who has met the Doctor and been inspired by him to try and be slightly less craven and self-interested than he was before. And if you were going to do a time travel epic story about any of the Doctor Who companions. You've got Romana, which would tie it to Gallifrey and be a Time Lord story, or you've got Turlough, because he was one of the other characters who did pilot the TARDIS, seemed to know what he was doing with it. So, yeah, the answer to the question is no, it isn't, but it might be like the 61st.
That's a good point, though. I think that this does sound like Turlough, and we didn't get a lot of Turlough on TV. He did have a few stories where he was spotlighted, but at least half of his TV serials, he is just there as a movable part, and Turlough's own personality or worldview never plays into the story at all. So while Mark Strickson always makes the best acting choices in a story like Warriors of the Deep or Five Doctors or The Awakening, and you're always looking at him when he's on camera, he's never given anything to say or do beyond generic lines. It's only the stories where Turlough comes to the forefront, like Enlightenment or Frontios or Planet of Fire, I've come to appreciate him as one of the best companions and one of the best actors Doctor Who ever had, because he does terrific work when the story is about him, and even when he's shoved deep into the background, he does terrific work in the margins. There are admittedly not a lot, because the dialogue is a little bit at a sharp angle to how people actually speak. There are some lines in this book, and I'll point them out in the audio essay, where he really does sound like he's reading lines that would have been script edited by Eric Saward for Mark Strickson in the early 1980s. So there are times here when the dialogue really does that grabbed me as being very much on point. Which leads to the third question, and I think you've already touched at this, but I'll ask it more formally. If someone who listens to this podcast has not read Turlough and the Earthling Dilemma, and that was me up until a week ago, my only reason that I read it was because of this podcast, and I would never have sat down to read this in the ordinary course of events. I certainly have a very large to-be-read pile, which has a lot more than just Doctor Who books in it. So this podcast is the reason why I'll be reading this. Well, I have read it, and it's the reason why I will be reading the Harry Sullivan's War, and it's the reason why I will be reading K-9 and Company, both companions of Doctor Who novels that I bought recently but have never read before. If someone has not read it, do you recommend that they pause the podcast, order the book from a local secondary retailer, wait for the book to arrive, read the book, and then come back and listen to the rest of this podcast, especially in the audio essay when I start breaking down spoilers as to what happens in it?
Well, I think to be in keeping with the spirit of the book, I should go back in time and read it and then listen to the podcast for the first time. But yeah, I think it's worth reading. It's the way you're reading it probably is the best way to read it, so that you can see how it belongs to the novelizations that came before it more than it belongs to the original stories that came long after it. So it's not a new adventure that somehow fell back in time. It is very much a target book, and not one of the best target books. But just for the novelty of what it's doing, and the Doctor being there in spirit but not in character, I think it is worth having a read at if you can get a copy of it and you're that way inclined. As a book, it zips along, and in some cases that's to the detriment of it. But every chapter is pretty much set on a different location. The underlying story gets branches in all sorts of different directions until it then finally comes back at the end, and a character just turns up who tells you what the answer to the mystery is. But you know, it's not a book that you can get bored with, I don't think, just because it zips along so fast and throws so many ideas at you.
Speaking of ideas, we are in 1986, towards the end of a time when Doctor Who had stopped being political or quote unquote woke. Barry Letts, very political. His real life ideas are always seeping into the show. And that makes for a terrific run of Doctor Who viewing between The Silurians, which is the first story he produces, and Robot, which is the last story he produces. Very angry stories, which have a lot to say about current events. Even Robot, which is basically King Kong. You then get to the Philip Hinchcliffe era, where it turns to storytelling and horror. And then you have the Graham Williams era, which is Doctor Who falling apart, and Graham Williams trying very hard to hold it together by force of will and not always succeeding. And then JNT was just looking to tell stories to move product, and he wasn't necessarily a political creature. However, we are, again, about 18 months away in real time from Andrew Cartmell joining Doctor Who as a means of overthrowing the Thatcher government. And the villain, who has already been deposed and is out of power when the book opens, but is mentioned frequently and is a major plot point.
Well, you're going to say the name, because I have no idea how to pronounce that.
I've been pronouncing it Rechtat, but obviously Rechtat is not just a silly space name that was drawn by Tony Atwood out of a random number generator. And this would be, of course, what does Rechtat actually mean when you spell it backwards?
So, famously, the villain in this story who pops up again at the end is Rechtak, which is Thatcher backwards, and was named after Margaret Thatcher, the Prime Minister at the time. It's a little bit teenage, because that's the only connection that she has to Thatcher. But in some ways, it does, again, prefigure what's coming later, because you also get, in a couple of years' time, you get the Happiness Patrol, where one of the main characters in that, the actress, decides that she's going to play them as Margaret Thatcher. And as you say, you've got Andrew Cartmell, who also decides Doctor Who can bring down the Thatcher government. Clearly, Tony Atwood got there first, and his way of doing it was naming a villain in a very odd way. it's not a name you can say easily, even in your head when you're reading. So every time it cropped up, I just had to say it as Thatcher.
But this is where Doctor Who is going to spend most of the next 40 years living, though, because the new adventures were highly political, not maybe in terms of party politics, but in terms of movements and ideas. Russell T. Davies often has politics break into his show. He had actual politicians serving on his show. There was the death of Tony Blair at the beginning of Aliens of London/World War III. So Doctor Who, living in the political realm and taking potshots at those in charge, those in power, is where Doctor Who is going to be living. So this book does really blaze a trail in that sense. And maybe, as you say, it was handled in a teenager way rather than in a more adult way. But it is trying to do something, and other much more significant Doctor Who figures going forward are going to follow it.
Especially when you look at what Doctor Who at the time that it came out was. You had Colin Baker and Eric Saywood, and God love them, they made interesting stories, but they didn't connect with the real world in any great way. And then you've got a story that is just so 80s, because it's all about nuclear war, the idea that politicians would blow up the entire planet for spurious reasons, and one of the bad guys is Margaret Thatcher. It isn't done in the most subtle or exciting way, but it does try to say, look, Doctor Who can talk about the real world. And it is showing that the people who were making the books of Doctor Who at the time were feeling that that's the way it needed to go. And then the new adventures became the ultimate expression of that.
And I prefer it when Doctor Who has a foot in and an eye on the real world, and it's commenting on things and is trying to show us a better way. And again, I'll come back to this in the audio essay, but Trion, after Rechtat is deposed, is being administrated by the Committee for Public Safety, which again is a real-life historic reference to France in the 1790s. And we are soon going to be getting the novelization of The Reign of Terror, which obviously is going to be treading the same ground. So I think this is a very intelligent book by design. Obviously, using the word Thatcher spelled backwards is not very subtle, but it's trying to do something a cut above a more silly outer space story, which is entirely apolitical, which is what we got for most of the late 70s and early 80s. So yeah, I don't think this is one of the 60 best Doctor Who books ever written. I think in terms of readability, it comes in towards the bottom. It is not on my personal list of my 60 favorite because I'm coming to it last. And there are a lot more books that came earlier, which are much more influential. But I think it is important to read because it is the first. And it does show us what Doctor Who can be and will be. And maybe Doctor Who didn't get there because of Turlough and the Earthling Dilemma. But the fact that the author was having these ideas that later come back and become mainstream in the show, I think attention has to be paid.
Yeah, I'd agree. And he obviously was a fan of Doctor Who. There's brief moments in it where you see stuff that's pulled in from beyond just what he would have been researching around Turlough. There's a moment in the books where there's a Time Lord character called the Magician, and he sits down on the floor of his TARDIS with his legs crossed and creates a cube using his mind to send a message off to the Time Lords and get a message back, which obviously everyone's going to know is a reference to the War Games. But if the only thing you've done is go, I'm going to write a book about Turlough, I'll just watch his stories and read his books, you wouldn't know that. So I do think Tony Atwood was a long-standing fan of the show. And he got the opportunity to do this and ran with it.
My initial thought when I reached The Magician is that The Magician is a bit of a cheat. It's a bit of an effort to make this a Doctor Who story without the Doctor in it by giving us a Doctor surrogate with the serial numbers rubbed off. I think The Magician is much more complex than that. He's more of a trickster figure, and he's enigmatic. And Turlough never knows what's going on inside of his head, which is not the Doctor that Peter Davison was giving us. And he was the most recent televised Doctor. He's certainly not what Colin Baker was doing. So in terms of antagonist or morally ambiguous Time Lords, we'll be getting a lot more of those in the new adventures. But I think The Magician is a pretty solid invention.
He's not bad. If you would gonna say that he was a Time Lord that we'd seen before, you would probably say he was the monk who'd come back for reasons of his own. As a character, he can veer towards being a deus ex machina. A lot of the time in the books, he performs the role of the author going, oh God, I need him to stop talking about this and now go off and do that. I know, I'll have the magician tell him that's what he does in the future. So he's not ideal, but he is interesting, and it's a good way to make the story feel like it is set in the Doctor Who universe, that there's time travel going on and the Time Lords go, we need to go and have a look at this and make sure everything's all right.
And it is adjacent to a plot point from the Two Doctors, so it does have its finger on the pulse. Maybe that was intentional, maybe it was not. But the same way that the Time Lords send an undercover agent to keep track of the Kartz Reimer module, that shows up again in this book. So I think it's a good idea that Tony Atwood has in parallel to what Robert Holmes had just done on television. Now that you have read this for the second time, you read it as a child, and you're reading it now as an author in your own right, do you envision reading this book again?
I would say probably not. But in part, that is because there's so much other stuff that's new that's coming out. But yeah, if I was looking to go back and revisit the old favourites, this wouldn't be one of them. But if you'd have asked me that before I'd reread it, I would have said it would. So I have now fulfilled that, and I don't need to do it again.
Well, I'm very happy that you volunteered for it on this show and that you're rereading it with us. Now that the Black Archive is out on Greatest Show, is there anything else you can share about what's coming up in store for you?
So at the moment, I've got nothing that's in a position that I can talk about it too much. I have submitted another Black Archive, but with the way the schedule works for that, they're booked up for about 3 years, I think. So it's, I don't know when that will come out or when I can say anything about it, but it's, they've got it and they'll be looking at it. And yeah, a couple of bits and bobs that aren't official yet.
Well, Dale, I want to thank you very much for rejoining us. We are not going to play a game in this episode because I don't think it's in keeping with this particular book. Obviously, we can't play against that cliffhanger for a book that does not have a TV parent with cliffhangers in it.
You could put me in a maze and see if I can get out. How about that?
Not sure how to do that in podcast form, but I will get back to you on that. All right, Dale, once again, thanks so much. And where else can people find your works or online?
Main place to find me is on my website, dalesmithonline.com, or I'm on Mastodon as Mr. Dale Smith if you want to talk to me.
And I will conclude with a question that Jim Sangster is having me ask everybody. The cover of Turlo and the Earthling Dilemma is not an Andrew Skilleter, who is doing most of the covers at this time, and it does rather famously steal a prop from the movie Star Trek III. And the illustration of Mark Strickson is perhaps not the most flattering version of how Mark Strickson looks, but I think it is a visually striking cover. I like any cover that has outer space in it. So the question is, in terms of the target range, what is your favorite target cover of all time?
I heard last week in the Death of the Daleks one did come up, but I think for me it would be Ghostlight. Doctor Who magazine did a poster of it that you could take out, and that was on my wall for about 15 years. And it's a really amazing bit of art, especially when it's bigger than the cover size. It's really beautiful.
Once again, thanks so much for joining us, and you will be back on the show to cover a book that is slightly shorter and a little more readable than Turlo and the Earthling Dilemma.
Thanks very much.
The Companions of Doctor Who, Turlo and the Earthling Dilemma by Tony Atwood. Paperback release date, May 15th, 1986. Cover artist, David McAllister. Of all the companions ever to travel with the Doctor in the TARDIS, Turlo was the most enigmatic and the most disturbing. Exiled from his home world, he saw the Doctor as a means of escape from Earth, and for that, he was prepared to kill. But just who was Turlo? And what happened to him after he left the Doctor? Now Turlo has returned to Tryon, but to a Tryon much changed since his exile. Who are the mysterious Guardswarmer? What is their secret purpose? And what is the shocking and terrifying link between Tryon and planet Earth? This is the first book, and this has been a weekly podcast for 2.5 years now, the first book that I haven't read yet. I didn't buy it when I first saw it in my beloved Walden Books on Long Island in 1986. At the time, I only wanted to read official novelizations and not made-up stories. It didn't help that I'd never heard of the author, Tony Atwood, whose only two previous publications, as per this book, were in the Blake's Seven universe, a TV series I knew of but had never watched, still haven't watched, in fact, in 2024. This line of thinking about not wanting to read original stories fortunately went away in 1991 when the novelizations were running out and the new adventures came into being. So what you're getting in this audio essay is my first fresh take on Turlough and the Earthlink Dilemma. This will only happen a small handful of times over the rest of the life of this podcast, so buckle up, my friends. And now, to cover for my lack of personal knowledge about the book, let me regale you with some fun facts, quoted verbatim from the Doctor Who wiki at tardis.fandom.com. Quote, "This has the distinction of being the first Doctor Who novel, as opposed to novellas or short stories, which is not based on a televised story, leading the way for the later Virgin Publishing New Adventures book series. It is also the first Doctor Who-related novel in which the Doctor does not actually play a role. It is not, however, the first original Doctor Who-related fiction to be published by Target Books. That distinction belongs to the novella Daleks, The Secret Invasion by Terry Nation, included in the 1979 release Terry Nation's Dalek Special. Other original short fiction has been published by other companies as early as the mid-1960s, and a novella, Doctor Who and the Invasion of Space, was published in 1966. Another quote from the wiki. "This was also the first single Target Books release to exceed 200 pages in length, and the only original format Target release, discounting the later bumper editions near the end of the line, to be published at such a length." Also a quote. "The space station, depicted on the cover, is a copy of the Earth space dock, originally featured in Star Trek III, The Search for Spock. The artwork had been modified from a piece of art that appeared on the back cover of the 1985 Laserdisc release of Star Trek III. The station would appear in the next three Star Trek films, while the same model was subsequently used to represent four different star bases in as many episodes of Star Trek The Next Generation, to which I, Jason, will add, this space station appears nowhere in the novel. Turlough and the Earthlink Dilemma." What else did I know before going in? Well, Turlough and the Earthlink Dilemma is generally regarded as a failure. A fan update to the discontinuity guide, written by Paul Clark and published at Hooniverse.net, says, quote, "A fairly shaky characterization of Turlough sadly ruins a complex plot filled with hard sci-fi ideas. Despite strange gaps in the continuity, it is nice to see that Tryon comes across as a well-rounded world with a fleshed-out history and culture." Graham Keeling, in a 2001 review written for Stacey Smith's ratings guide, calls it quite hard-going, slightly amateurish, and a difficult read. Richard Radcliffe, for the same site, in 2002, asks of Turlough, "Did we really want this much information?" and says the book, quote, "has to be judged a failure on enhancing Turlough's character beyond the TV screen." Radcliffe calls the story, among other things, quote, "garbled, atrocious, and page upon page of mind-numbing dullness, which, quote, bored him stupid." The book is unique among the original Targets run for having an introduction, penned by Mark Strickson, the phenomenal actor and phenomenal convention guest who brought Turlough to life. I love that bit. Strickson signs his name with a drawing of Turlough's signature striped tie and makes accurate comments about Turlough's limited role in most of his TV episodes. The book starts with a three-page prologue. In one sense, this is an unprepossessing data dump about the history of Tryon. Densely written, it's the kind of thing you need to read two or three times to untangle. I see what Atwood is trying to do. It's kind of like one of Terence Dix's world-building, myth-making prologues, giving you the history of the Planet of the Month. Think the history of Skanos and the prologue to the Horns of Nymon novelization. Chapter 1 introduces Turlough through the eyes of a Tryon tour guide. Turlough has come home after the events of Planet of Fire, and people assumed he would lead and help rebuild the planet. But instead, he's just wandering around museums and tour guide-narrated caverns. The writing is dull, and there's too much of it. Atwood uses the word overmuch, which, pro tip, don't. But Atwood is also clearly well-read. The prologue and first chapter reference Margaret Thatcher, Shakespeare's Julius Caesar. Turlough has a, quote, lean, hungry look, and see last week's episode 105, the Time Lash novelization for that same quote. And also there's a mention or an allusion to the French Revolution. The Thatcher analog tyrant was replaced on Tryon by the, quote, Committee on Public Safety. But let's be frank, what the book is about is less important to me than that it exists, the first original full-length Doctor Who novel ever. It has a long line of glorious descendants, and also some black sheep that we never talk about, the Brunos of the various Virgin Publishing and BBC Books lines. But of course, at some point, the thrill of reading a new novel that you've never read before wears off pretty early on, buffeted by Atwood's tendency towards clunky dialogue and oppressive exposition. This is not a fun book to read aloud. The two main characters are Tolo and his betrothed, a woman named Juris. Juris, a collaborator with Rechtat's regime, is doing something with gravity, and Tolo himself builds a rudimentary time machine. Why? Because he wants to know why the Doctor spent so much time, out of all the universe, in the British Isles. So this isn't an original novel per se. It's a novel about Doctor Who, about the show's mythology. And the author has theories for us, tying into an enemy race, the Gardsormr, G-A-R-D-S-O-R-M-R, drawn from Norse mythology, evidently. Now, books written to prove a private fan theory are usually treated skeptically. I did read the New Adventure Guidelines in the mid-90s when I had designs towards submitting towards the line, and the NA Guidelines specifically cautioned against writing this type of book. Now, if the writing style and dialogue are magical, this kind of book is okay, but that's not really the case here. Only a few times in the book does Tolo get to deliver a realistic line of dialogue that sounds more like something Mark Strickson would have said during season 20. Page 74, quote, "These folks have the most staggering ability to see genuine examples of alien civilizations as fakes and frauds." Now, the magician is described as using 10 words where one would do, which seems a rather self-reviewing detail of the book as a whole. The 13 chapters are named for the 13 decks in a single suit in a deck of playing cards, though the titles are slightly altered to fit the plot. Nearly every chapter takes place in a different locale, or time zone, or reality. There are only three proper characters. Beyond Tolo and Juris is the Magician, an itinerant Time Lord who follows the Tryon power couple around, mostly remaining silent, but sometimes offering suspiciously effusive praise, or sometimes offering oblique advice that Tolo has to interpret, and at one point urging Tolo to kill another character, the female character. That's normally a gigantic red flag. But Doctor Who, the enigmatic character who urges you to commit murder, is almost always the big bad. But no, in this case, Tolo follows the advice, and in terms of the book's internal logic, it winds up being the right thing to do. Now, I nearly gave up on the book entirely at that point, and didn't finish. But I did finish, and the author circles around and writes this seeming wrong by the very end. It's an odd book for reasons Dale and I discussed earlier. There's no one principal locale, and only those three proper characters. Much of the book is consumed with dreary prose, tons of run-on sentences, and impossible dialogue, exactly the way that nobody talks in real life. The central concern of the book is theoretical physics. The two antagonists, Rechtat and the Gardsormr, are kept absent until the tail end of the book. Tolo physically assaults Juris not just once, not twice, but, and this is not gratifying at all, three times over. Again, for reasons which the plot contrives to justify. So there's not a lot of there. I can't envision ever reading this again. But at the same time, to echo what Dale said earlier, I admire and I respect this book for being the first original Doctor Who novel, to show us that it could be done, to show us that it should be done. Atwood has good ideas. The book that comes out in 1986, which has much to say about Thatcherism, nuclear war, political revolutions, and the mythology of one's own homeworld, is a far more thought-provoking read than you might have expected. I'm not positive this would have been publishable in the NA or MA lines, which were to come 5 years later. The plot is dense, and the prose and dialogue are not up to later standards. But for a book about Turlo, and alternate realities, and nuclear annihilation, and Time Lords, well, its hearts are in the right place. Next time on Doctor Who Literature, we are back in season 22. We are back in the middle of the Colin Baker era, and we are to meet, for the first time, a Target book written by two authors, and not just one. That husband and wife couple who have a somewhat sideways relationship to prose and complete sentences. This will not be their only book. They will come back a few more times in the Target range. They are not perhaps the most beloved of Doctor Who writers, but they are a very important part of the Colin Baker era and the Sylvester McCoy era, come to find out. The writers in question are Pip and Jane Baker. And next week, I'll be joined by a first-time guest on this show, but a popular podcast guest elsewhere in Doctor Who fandom. I'll be joined by Michael Storm to discuss Doctor Who, The Mark of the Rani. Thank you for joining me on another episode of Doctor Who Literature. This podcast is produced by David Barsky, Jim Sangster, and yours truly. This week's episode was written and edited by me. Our logo was designed by Jim Sangster. Special thanks to my special guest, Dale Smith. This podcast can be found on most of your podcast apps of choice. You can find all past episodes at podcasters.spotify.com/pod/show/Doctor Who Lit. It really helps if you rate 5 stars and subscribe. You can find me on Blue Sky and YouTube at Doctor Who Novels, that's Dr. Who Novels, and on email at Doctor Who Literature, that's drwholiterature@gmail.com. Please drop me a line with your comments, questions, and suggestions. Thank you for listening, and whatever you do, keep turning the pages.
Doctor Who Podcast Network.